What happens when a wife loses her husband, has no children who can support her, and has never worked outside the home? How much can the church possibly do for someone with that level of need? John MacArthur shows you next on today's Grace to You. Injured and gassed in World War I, George Hansen was discharged from the Army and returned to his North Dakota home. Physically, he was never quite the same. Mr. Hansen and his wife Clara never had children, and George died in 1945. Well, Clara then lived as a widow until she died at her 100th birthday in 1996. While most widows' stories aren't as extreme as Clara Hansen's, living 51 years on her own, every widow faces the prospect of living for years without someone to provide for her. So what happens to women in that situation? What should happen? Whose responsibility are widows? When it's hard to have enough time and resources for your own family, how can you possibly care for a widow as well? Stay with us for today's Grace to You as John MacArthur answers important questions like those in that study he's bringing us this week called Caring for Widows. Here's John MacArthur.
Open your Bible to our study of 1 Timothy chapter 5, and beginning at verse 3, a section on widows in the church. It may seem at the very outset that that's a rather small subject, a rather insignificant subject, certainly not one of the weightier subjects that ought to occupy our minds, but just the opposite is true. It is a very important subject. It is a very far-reaching subject. In fact, Paul speaks to this issue from verse 3 all the way through verse 16, a very prolonged discussion of the matter of widows in the church. It is for the instruction of Timothy, who is giving leadership to the church at Ephesus. It is for the instruction of any church. It is for our instruction as well, and we shall note that as we study the passage. He gives five principles. The first principle is this. Verse 3. Honor widows who are real widows. Honor widows who are real widows. Principle number one, then, in verse 3. The obligation of the church to support widows. The obligation of the church to support widows. I want you to notice the word widows, because this really is the basis of all of our understanding. Honor widows that are real widows. Now, what do we mean by widows? To us, the word means a woman whose husband is dead. The Greek word includes that, but is not limited to that. That's a very important statement. The Greek word includes that, but is not limited to that. The word widow is kera. It is a word that's a feminine form of an adjective used as a noun. It is an adjective. It means bereft. It means robbed. It means having suffered loss. It carries the idea of being alone. It comes from keras. And that's what that means, bereft, robbed, having suffered loss, being left alone. The word, then, doesn't speak about how a woman got into this situation. It just describes the situation. She is alone. She is bereft. She has suffered the loss of her husband. It doesn't say how she lost the husband. Usually, of course, we would think she lost the husband through death. There is nothing in this word to indicate that it is limited to that. In fact, if you do any kind of study of the word and trace it through any classical Greek usages, you will find that the word means a woman who lost her husband in any fashion, death, divorce, desertion, anything. That can all be summed up in this word. Now, I want you to know that this expands the accountability and the responsibility of the church immeasurably. Because what we're talking about here is a responsibility to take care of all those women who have lost their husband, which is a very, very large company of women. Maybe as large now as at any time in the world's history, with divorce and desertion and all of those things, such a common everyday matter. Verse 5 helps us to understand further the word. It uses the word widow again, and then it says, a widow who is a real widow and desolate. That is a passive participle that means having been left alone. And again, it doesn't have the idea of death in it. It simply describes the state of a woman who has been left alone because her husband is no longer present. In those days, women could not find honorable employment easily. There were no secular institutions to care for them, and so they were in serious straits. They were very often reduced to poverty unless their husband had left something with them, or their father had left an inheritance to them, or perhaps they were under the care of a father's family or a mother-in-law's family or friends or whatever. But many widows were left destitute, and as I said, there was no honorable employment available to women because women were seen as being cared for within the context of the family and the home, not caring for themselves outside that context. The treatment of these women then was a watershed, was a test case for the love of Christ born in the hearts of the Christian community. Their spiritual character, the demonstration of their devotion to Christ, could be seen in how they cared for people who were desperately in need of that care. So what we're talking about here, and you've got to grab this one, is those women who have been bereft of a husband, whatever the reason might be. The word then is honor. That's what we're to do for these women, to honor them. What does that mean? What does it mean? It's the verb timao. It means to show respect, to show care, to give support, to treat graciously, and it encompasses the idea of meeting needs, whatever they are, financially, of course. In fact, it is used of pricing something in Matthew 27:9, to put a value on something and then to care for that in light of its value. And certainly there's nothing more valuable than one made by God than a believing woman, and nothing more precious to the church than a believing woman desperately in need of the church's care. The word honor implies financial support. I'll show you how we know that. Go back to Matthew 15. In Matthew 15, Jesus is confronted by the scribes and Pharisees in verse 1. And they said, "Why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders?" Now, the tradition of the elders was a whole compilation of laws and rules that the Jews had developed that were non-biblical. Some of them contradicted the Bible. All of them added to the Scripture. Some of them tried to explain it one way or another, but they were additions to Scripture. Very often they obscured. In fact, really, by the time they collected all of the stuff, it fairly well obscured the intent of Scripture. But believing early on that they had the job of fencing in the law of God, they started to put the fence up, and the fence was all these rules, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of rules and interpretations that they thought would fence in the law and protect it from being violated. These became the traditions. One of the traditions was that before you ate, you went through a ceremonial cleansing. It wasn't sanitation. It had nothing to do with having clean hands. It had only to do with religious ceremony. So there was a ceremonial washing, and it grew out of the fact that some Jews believed that there was a demon named Shibtah, and that demon dwelt on the hands of people. And if you ate without a religious purification, the demon would come inside of you. So in order to avoid being possessed by a demon, you went through a ceremonial hand-washing ceremony. Well, Jesus' disciples ate without going through that ceremony. It wasn't a biblical ceremony. There was nothing in the Bible about it at all. It was a tradition that had grown up. So they ignored it. So the Pharisees and scribes come to Jesus and they say, "Why do your disciples violate the tradition of the elders and not go through this ceremonial washing to get Shibtah off their hands?" His reply was, "Why do you violate the commandment of God with your tradition?" And then he gives them an illustration of how they were breaking the commandment of God with their tradition. Here's how. "You say, whosoever shall say to his father or his mother, 'It's a gift, it's korban,' referring to whatever you might be profited by me, doesn't honor his father or his mother," he says in verse 6. Now, what do you mean by this? Listen, Exodus 20:12, honor your father and mother, right? Ten Commandments, Exodus 20:12, honor your father and mother. What does that mean? To the Jews, it meant give them money when they need it, support them, care for them. But here's what tradition had grown up. If you have some money and you say, it is a gift, it is korban, it is devoted to God, I pledge it to God, I promise it to God, I vow it to God, then it can't ever go to a lesser person until you could rescind that vow. So when someone's parents had a need, instead of meeting that need, these ungodly Jews would take this tradition and they would say, boy, I would sure like to give that to you, but it is korban. I have already committed it to God and I certainly couldn't take it from God to give it to you. It was a way of protecting their money from having to be given to their elders. And it showed the evil of their hearts. It showed that they had no desire at all to support their parents. So he's saying to them, you've developed this little tradition called korban by which you violate the commandment of God to honor your father and mother. What I want you to see out of this is that Jesus says in interpreting Exodus 20:12 that that honor means giving them money. It means financial support. And you're not willing to do it, so you shelter your money with this foolish tradition and you show yourself, verse 7, to be hypocrites. Hypocrites. You say you do it for God and all you want to do is keep it back from your parents. So now back to 1 Timothy. When Paul says, honor widows, using the same idea and really borrowing the thought right out of Exodus 20:12, honoring your mother, honoring your father. When he says honor widows, he has in mind not just respect and not just regard, but he has also in mind financial support. That basically means they cared for you when you were young, you care for them when their need arises in their old age. So honor widows means to support them, not only with respect and kindness and favor, but with financial aid. Now, what are the widows that are to be supported? It says honor widows that are real widows, or widows indeed, genuine widows. That same phrase is mentioned in verse 5 again, genuine widows, widows indeed. Now, what does that mean? Truly bereft, truly alone, truly without resources. Not every woman is in that situation. Not every woman is really bereft. Many husbands have left their wives with wonderful resources. They've left them with a home, a bank account, an insurance policy, whatever it might be, so that they have the wherewithal to care for their needs financially. In that regard, we may not have a responsibility financially to a widow. That doesn't mean we don't have a responsibility in terms of spiritual assistance, in terms of graciousness, kindness, whatever care they might need in their personal life, their spiritual life, or whatever. But the point is, financial support is to go to widows who are real widows. That is, they have no other source of income. They have lost their husband. They are desolate, as verse 5 uses the word, or literally, they have been left totally alone and without resources. That's the idea. And again, I reiterate to you, and you can read the section in Kittel, in which he defines this word keira, and points out so clearly, this means any woman who has lost her husband. We have a responsibility, if she is desolate and has no other resource, to take up her case. Now, in our society, as I said, fortunately, because of the effect of Christianity, we have a welfare system, which, by the way, is continuously defrauded. We trust not by Christian widows who are deserving. We need to come alongside that system, and that system can do so much, perhaps, to provide for a widow. There may be many other needs, and I know in the life of our church, we are committed to the fact, and we continually are eager to serve those widows for whom that is not enough to sustain their life, to serve them in some ways which can make possible them meeting their needs. This instruction is very basic. It includes the whole idea of honoring your father and mother, and of caring for people with the compassion of the heart of God who is unusually drawn to those who are in this situation. Now, let me just give you a footnote here at this point, just to kind of help you see the picture of our society. I have said in the beginning of the message, and I say it again with emphasis, that in the future, the burden on the church regarding the care of women who have lost their husband is going to increase. We're grateful for living in a country where there is a system that provides some money for those people. The church comes alongside to do everything to make sure that widows' needs are met. Now, obviously, in every individual case, the ascertaining of what need is becomes the real issue. Some women, before their husband left, were used to living on $18,000 a year. Some were used to living on $30,000, some $50,000, some $70,000 a year, or whatever. And we have to take a long look at what standard of living is necessary, not necessarily what standard of living is desired. But we have to be faithful to meet the needs as we feel the needs are right and just and fair relative to the number of children, the number of mouths to be fed, the educational demands, the transportation needs in any given situation. The church has the obligation and the privilege of providing for real widows who have no resources. Where they have financial resources, I believe we still are to come alongside them with encouragement and love and care and support in every way possible on the spiritual level. We need to give attention to that. So first of all, it's very important to understand that our society is moving in a direction that is going to raise the level of the church's responsibility immeasurably. Now later on in this text, we're going to find out that families ought to take care of their own in verse 4. But what we're finding today is, and it's going to be even worse in the future, is the disintegration of the family is totally destroying that networking. What happens, for example, when a woman is raised in a broken home? Maybe her mother's been married a couple times. She's had a father and a stepfather, which is not atypical at all, but somewhat common. She goes off into a career kind of orientation. Maybe she doesn't get married till she's 26, 27, 28, 29. By that time, she's charted her own course. She marries somebody who's charted his own course. They get together. Something happens to him. She's out there. She's had sort of a career kind of background. She's had a very messed up family situation. He dies. She's left with a couple of little kids on her hands. She can't plug back into an intimate family network because it's long gone if there ever was one, and the burden on the church is even greater. You see, the price to pay for the disintegration of the family is really monumental. Those widowed women, those women who lose their husbands need to be able, as Genesis 38 illustrates, to move back into the home of family one way or another, but so often that can't happen, or it won't happen, because of the disintegration of the family. The tragedy and the breakdown of the family is the loss of the support network, and it puts the burden even greater on the church. So first of all, the church has an obligation to support widows. Second point, and we just introduced this with one verse, the obligation of the church to evaluate those widows needing support. It's not a question of everybody get in line, we're just going to give it away. We have to evaluate. The church cannot indiscriminately take on everyone who applies for help. There has to be some criteria, and that comes in verses 4 through 8. I just want to introduce verse 4. I think it's so interesting, so important. If any woman who's bereft of a husband, any widow, has children or grandchildren, ekgona means descendants or grandchildren, not nephews. Now, many widows in the church have children and grandchildren. It is the responsibility of the children and the grandchildren to support that widow. That's what he's saying. It says, let them, that is the children and grandchildren, learn first to show their godliness in the family. The word home, oikos, referring to family. You say you're godly, then let's see it in your family. By the way, the theater in which the true act of godliness or ungodliness is put on is the family. The home, right? When you come to church, you are what we think you are, and you are what you want us to think you are. But in the family, you are what you are. You are what you are. There are no masks in the family. So if you have children or grandchildren, it is their obligation, it is their reciprocation as close relatives to care for that widow. That's the family's responsibility. And down in verse 8, it says, if you don't do that, you're worse than an unbeliever. The family has the first responsibility to take care of widows before they are ever put on the church's list of responsibility. It starts with your own family. Let them first, and that is first as an adverb in time, priority. The first thing before you do anything else is to show and practice your godliness to your own family. And how do you practice your godliness to your own family? By caring for those in your family who have need. As a general principle, you know, you could just preach on that for weeks. The family is the context where true spirituality is revealed. In chapter 3, for example, an elder had to rule his own house well and have his children in submission with seriousness. A deacon, verse 12, had to have his own children and his own house under control. The home is the proving ground of godliness. And he says, if there's any widow who has children or grandchildren, let them practice first of all their godliness in their family. They have a responsibility to care for that widow, that woman who has lost her husband. You claim to be godly. You claim to be reverent. Don't tell me how many Bible studies you go to. Don't tell me how much theology you know. Tell me first that you demonstrate in your family your godliness. Let's look at that as a general thought. Young people, you say you're godly and you're growing and you're studying the Bible and you're going to Bible studies and you're going to ministry. That's fine. But first, show me your relationship to your parents. Show me how you treat your mother. Show me how you treat your father. Sisters, show me how you treat your brother. Brother, show me how you treat your sister. And I'll show you where your godliness lies. Mother, show me how you treat your children. Father, how you treat your wife. And so it goes, right? The family is the proving ground. And don't tell me about your godliness. First, put it on display in your family. First, show your godliness at home, in the house, before you make a speech about it anyplace else. I've thought to myself that one of the things we ought to do in a seminary application is to ask the mother to write a letter of reference. What kind of son is this young man? And what are the evidences of godliness that you have seen in the home? We might cut down our applications a bit with such a process, but it might be well worth it. Because that's where godliness is proven. It's proven in the home. Specifically, he says, in this case, if any widow has children or grandchildren, let them demonstrate, first of all, their godliness in the home or in the family, and to give back some return to their parents. That's the phrase. To give back some return to their parents. What a privilege. And so when it comes to the basic responsibility, it starts in the home. And I'm telling you, we're going to see in the future daughters and mothers in some cases, and sisters and nieces and aunts and so forth who are going to become bereft of their husband through divorce, desertion, imprisonment, death. And it's up to us as families to demonstrate our godliness in the proper care of those women. First of all, if there's no such care available, or if the family is unwilling to do that, then the church steps in, and then the woman is a true widow in the sense that she has no means of support. But the initial line of responsibility belongs in the family of that woman. It is a privilege to do that on behalf, certainly, of a mother. I'm always encouraged when I find and meet children who are supporting their widowed mother. I know several of our elders whose widowed mothers live with them. That's very common. I grew up in a home where I shared my room with my grandmother who was widowed. I didn't always like that, but I didn't always have the right perspective either. But that's an honorable thing, and that's the heart of God. That's compassionate. That's as it ought to be. You notice the end of verse 4 says, that is acceptable before God, based upon the fifth commandment of Exodus 20:12. It is acceptable unto God when children honor their parents. And we have a responsibility to care for our parents, particularly those widowed ones.
That's John MacArthur, pastor, best-selling author, president of the Master's College and Seminary, and featured Bible teacher here on Grace to You. John calls the study Caring for Widows. John, let me ask, this issue of widowhood raises a number of questions, not the least of which are financial ones. You can understand a recent widow wondering, how will my needs be met? Or grown children wondering how they're going to meet mom's needs now that their dad is gone. The worries begin to pile up, don't they?
They really do. And of course, today we have so much quality medical care that older people live longer and longer and longer all the time, which means that widows live
longer. And it puts a burden on the family, and if there's no family, it puts the burden on the Christian community to take care of these widows. Part of being able to do that is to understand biblical financial principles. I'd like to offer a free audio lesson to anyone who asks on the subject, what did Jesus really say about financial worry? Bottom line, you need to know how to get out from under worrying about your finances, have a surplus so that you can have it available when needs come along. If you're already a widow or you're caring for a widow in your home, we'd like to send this to you free. So we'll send you a free copy of What Did Jesus Really Say About Financial Worry? And this is for anyone who is a widow or caring for a widow and you'd like some help. It is a 2-CD album or 2 individual cassettes, very limited time offer. Just important note, we're able to make this free offer if you're hearing us in the United States or Canada. Outside those regions, this study on financial worry is available for purchase and very reasonably. Contact us now.
Again, if you're a widow or you're caring for a widow and you're hearing us in the U.S. and Canada, call now and ask for your free audio study called What Did Jesus Really Say About Financial Worry? Get in touch today. Dial our toll-free number. It's 1-800-55-GRACE. Again, 800-55-GRACE. If you're in Canada, the number there is 1-800-565-2425. Again, 1-800-565-2425. You can also reach us by email with a request. Ask for the title, What Did Jesus Really Say About Financial Worry? Write to us at letters@gty.org. Again, letters@gty.org. And of course, you can use the regular mailing address, which is Grace to You, Post Office Box 4000, Panorama City, California, 91412. Now remember, this series on financial worry is free. If you're a widow or you're caring for a widow, call toll-free 1-800-55-GRACE. And if you'd like to purchase John's current study called Caring for Widows or any of our resources, check online at the catalog there, gty.org, or call our toll-free number, 1-800-55-GRACE. Let me also remind you about Grace to You's television program, Sunday afternoons at 5 p.m. Eastern Time on DirecTV Channel 378 or on local channels in Detroit, Houston, and Chicago. For the times and listings, the stations, or to watch online, go to gty.org. For John MacArthur, Mark Lind, our broadcast writer, and the entire staff, we're encouraging you to return Wednesday for another half hour of Unleashing God's Truth, one verse at a time, here on Grace to You. How ready are you to help a widow who's lonely, anxious, short of money? You might be more equipped than you think, as you'll learn tomorrow on the next Grace to You.